We live on the Ring of Fire, so earthquakes are not unusual or unexpected, but they're always unnerving, such as the 7.1 magnitude quake that shook Kenai Peninsula and Anchorage residents out of bed at 1:30 on a recent Sunday morning. Scientists are examining the data collected from seismic monitors in South Central and across the state. We've got some of the experts with us to hear about what they're learning and how that information may be used to improve communication and infrastructure protection in the future. Today on Talk of Alaska.
Today's program is underwritten in part by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline and its operations today and into the future.
Alaska's tobacco quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their home. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins lead to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Hello, welcome to Talk of Alaska. More than 1 minute. That's how long the January 24th earthquake shook. I've heard from some Alaskans who felt like it lasted much longer than that, but officially it was just over a minute. The 1964 earthquake, by comparison, was more than 4 minutes and was a magnitude 9.2. Yikes. Here to help us better understand what's happening during an event and with some context for comparing the severity of different earthquakes are Michael West. Michael is a state seismologist. He works at the Alaska Earthquake Center at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, and he joins us through our media partners at KUAC in Fairbanks. Welcome, Michael.
Good morning. Thanks.
Good morning. Thanks for being here. In the Anchorage studio with me are two engineers, John Aho and John Thornley. Dr. Aho is trained as an earthquake engineer as well as aeronautical and astronautical engineering. Sounds very complicated and very interesting. You've been on the Geotechnical Advisory Commission for decades and the State Seismic Hazards Safety Commission for about a decade, is that correct?
Since its inception, yeah.
All right. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And Mr. John Thornley, we have two Johns in the studio today, so I'll try to make the distinction with your last name so that people know who we're hearing from. Mr. Thornley is a geotechnical engineer and works for Golder Associates in Anchorage. He's very involved with the Strong Motion Network and also is on the Geotechnical Advisory Commission. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for being here. We'll also be joined at the bottom of the hour by Jeremy Zedek, who is with the State Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management. It's going to be a busy program, so let's get to it. And of course, you Alaskans are welcome and encouraged to join us. The call-in number across the state is 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK. If you're in Anchorage, the local number is 550-8422. 550-8422, or you can email us talk@alaskapublic.org. Did you feel shaking or not? Because it varied quite a bit. So, Michael, I want to start with you. It's not unusual to have earthquakes in Alaska, but everyone is different. What are the unique characteristics of the 7.1 that we experienced on the 24th?
Well, the things that stand out to me about that earthquake are that it occurred relatively deep, about 80 miles or so beneath the surface. Again, that's not unusual at all. However, many of our commonly sort of felt earthquakes are not necessarily from that region. This was larger than we are used to expecting from the earthquakes, not at the surface of the earth, but kind of down deeper. And we'll get into some details probably in the next hour or so about how that might have influenced or changed what people felt. But to me, that's one of the reminders from this. And also, the second one is that because of that depth, nobody was actually close to it. Even, you know, you see a point on a map, but we forget that this earthquake occurred deep beneath the surface. So even if you were standing right above it, on the surface of the earth, you were still 80 miles away.
We use a magnitude scale to describe how large earthquakes are. give us a little refresher course on how that scale works. Maybe compare the difference between the 6.4 Iliamna earthquake of last summer and the recent 7.1.
Sure. So the magnitude scale is pretty visionary, actually, set up originally by Charles Richter. And it attempted to take what are pretty nuanced scientific measurements and convert it to a number that we can all carry around in our head. I mean, my kids understand the difference between 5, 6, 7. That's a whole lot easier than referring to, you know, 10 to the 17th ergs or some physical unit. So that scale, in order to make it work, was logarithmic. And a lot of your listeners probably know that, but there's sort of this, every time you go up in one number, you're going up by an order of magnitude. So it gets complicated, but let's reduce it to this. An earthquake that is one magnitude unit higher has about 30 times as much energy in it. So comparing the Iliamna earthquake last summer to this one, you're talking about an earthquake last week that was about 30 times more energetic.
That is so interesting because I don't understand why it has to be complicated. Now I feel foolish that your kids understand it, and I still feel like I really don't. 30 times, I thought that it was only 10 times that every number represented 10. So understanding that it's 30 really helps me see that there is a vast difference between just one number to the next.
Yeah, there's a lot of nuance in there. The factor of 10 is in the actual size of the displacements or the movement, the strength of the shaking, if you will. But in order to do that, you're actually looking at energies that are about 30 times stronger. We'll spare the listeners equations on paper here. Maybe that's the benefit of radio.
Absolutely. Dr. Aho, you were nodding there for a second. Would you like to add something to how we understand how this works?
No, I guess the only thing I'd like to understand, maybe have Mike explain a little bit, is the difference between moment magnitude and Richter magnitude. That seems to be a confusion with the general public.
Mm. You know, that's a great question, because we talk about the size of a magnitude as if there's some well-known unit that we're all using. But really, if I ask you how big an earthquake is, what do you want to know? Do you want to know how big the fault was? How much the fault moved, how much energy was released from it. I used an analogy the other day with someone trying to talk about the size of a piece of fruit. You know, how big is a pear? Well, do you want to measure its mass? Do you want to measure its height, its circumference? There's lots of different measures we could use. And earthquakes, you can measure a number of different ways. The one that is the most scientifically accepted these days is actually kind of a hard concept. John just referred to this, the idea of moment, which is you can think about kind of like the torque of an earthquake. If you've got one side of a fault moving one direction and one the other, you're really kind of torquing the earth. And that unit of measure is something that we actually are able to measure, and it has proven to be a very successful metric for measuring an earthquake, but there's nothing holy about it.
If you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska, and today we are talking about earthquakes and structural integrity of buildings and what the latest science is on earthquakes and tsunamis, and we'll also talk a little bit about early warning systems and what science is saying about those things as well. Joining me today for Talk of Alaska, Michael West is the state seismologist. He is on a line from KUAC in Fairbanks, and in the studio with me, I have John Aho, who is a retired structural engineer, and John Thornley, who is a geotechnical engineer. And we will also be joined by Jeremy Zedek for a few moments at the bottom of the hour to talk about what we should all be doing as Alaskans to prepare ourselves. You can join our conversation at 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-TALK, or in Anchorage, 550-8422, 550-8422. Or talk at alaskapublic.org if you want to email some questions. The numbers are also on the homepage at alaskapublic.org, so if you didn't quite get that, you can look there to find the numbers for calling in. Please describe the waves of an earthquake. There's primary, shear, and body. Who wants to take that question? Come on, I know you all know.
Well, I can talk a little bit about it.
Please do.
The primary wave is essentially the first wave you feel, and it's a type of wave that isn't as damaging as the other waves to structures. And Mike probably knows a lot more about the waves than I do, but I'll take a shot at it. And that particular wave can't move through liquids. It moves relatively fast. And then the second jolt you feel is the shear or secondary wave. That can be very damaging. That's one of the most damaging of the waves. And as I say, that's one of the most damaging of the waves. Then the body waves are the Love and Rayleigh waves, and those again are very damaging type waves, and they have certain ways of movement that probably Mike, as a seismologist, could explain much better than I can.
I saw the write up in the Anchorage Daily News with that really cool graph of the motion in Anchorage, and it sort of described the primary wave as a punch in the face, and the shear wave as, there was some kind of visual language there. Michael, was that your description of those waves, or how did they come up with that?
No, but I like that a lot. That's good. Kind of the primary wave might be the punch in the face, and then the secondary waves might be the grabbing you by the shoulders and shaking you back and forth. I might use that.
All right. Toward the end of the 7.1 on January 24th, I felt like I had just hit land after a few days at sea. That slow rolling sensation, I thought, am I just kind of dizzy or upset? But I looked outside and saw a big spruce tree in my front yard still wavering back and forth. So I thought, okay, there is still movement here. Just as there was somewhat dramatic differences in the amount of shaking experienced throughout South Central, people have reported feeling this earthquake for longer than 1 minute. What's the reality there? Does it just feel longer because we're nervous and upset? Or is it possible that it did last longer than a minute in some areas?
We live in an interesting geologic environment where we have strong motions that bounce around in what we call the basin, the Anchorage Basin, for a bit longer than you would notice if you were up on, say, out in the Chugach. And so I think one of the best visual descriptors is to think about a container with Jell-O in it, and we have your hand on the edge of the container, and you're shaking that Jell-O back and forth. And when you stop shaking the Jell-O container, the Jell-O container stops. But if you're looking at the Jell-O continues to shake around a little bit longer than the edge of the container. And so that's essentially an analogy of what's happening in the Anchorage Basin. And so when you have a nice magnitude 6 or 7 earthquake, you'll feel the earthquake, and then for a little while longer, you'll feel these long rolling movements, and those are the earthquake waves moving back and forth and bouncing around in the basin.
It's interesting to hear an engineer describe a 6 or 7 as nice. I think other people would have a different word for that, but Dr. Aho. Hey.
Oh, I really don't have anything to add to that.
Michael, did you want to
jump in?
Sure, please.
Yeah, I wanted to reinforce what John Thornley said. For comparison, the actual amount of time that it took this earthquake to rupture, that is, the movement on the fault, was probably just about 10 or 15 seconds. Mm. And everything else that was felt is exactly those kind of phenomena that John is describing. And discussions of how long it lasted are kind of esoteric in a way. I mean, they're meaningful to people who felt it, but I kind of liken it to standing in a narrow canyon and shouting and then asking how long the echoes last. Well, they kind of tail off for a long time until you just don't quite hear them anymore. And same thing with the earthquake. It's very hard to put a definitive end on the shaking.
Well, we had a question from a listener that emailed a question that said, why isn't the duration of shaking routinely reported along with the magnitude? And I guess you've just answered why, because it varies quite a bit. Is that correct?
Yeah, and technically maybe doesn't have an end, or it just kind of becomes no longer noticeable. For really massive earthquakes, magnitudes 8s and 9s, we can measure the vibrations going around the Earth for days at an instrumental level. So what's the duration? Well, again, it seems like some ancient proverb or, you know, some sort of mind game.
Something to figure out. Another question by email is, the earthquake 2 weeks ago was deep, but can you talk a bit more about the effects on local geology, such as the McHugh complex in relation to the earthquake 2 weeks ago? Is that something that one of you wants to tackle, or...?
Sure. I'm not familiar with the McHugh complex. John, you know?
Well, go ahead, John.
John Thornley.
So again, as we were talking a little bit before, the Anchorage Basin is a complex geologic environment. We have a number of different geologic units, the glacial till, the bootlegger cove formation, which often people call the bootlegger clays. That were so problematic in the 64 earthquake, along with the McHugh Creek formation and some others. And so each of these formations has a different stiffness, if you will, and responded to the earthquake slightly differently. And one of the neat things that we've been able to do is instrument a lot of the Anchorage Basin and make those measurements. And so right now we're looking at the responses of those different units to evaluate how stiff they were and how they behaved.
Let's talk a little bit about that. The seismic array in Anchorage, it's been in place for a while, but this event on the 24th, if I'm understanding it correctly, was sort of the best test yet. How many sensors are there, and what was learned in this 7.1 earthquake? Well, Dr. Aho.
That varies as far as how many instruments are actually operating, but when the instrumentation was initially put in place, we had 24 instruments that were financed by the Alaska Science and Technology Foundation. And at that particular point, the USGS became very interested in the fact that we had a fairly dense instrumentation in Anchorage, and they came in with another 12 or 14 instruments. So I think we have between 35 and 40 instruments in the basin.
And there are a few different types of instruments. So we've got structural instruments and instrumentation. We've also got what we call free field instruments that sit at the surface away from a structure, away from other effects. And then we also have what we call the downhole array that's at the Delaney Park near the engine 556. Yeah. And so there are a few different sets of instrumentation that
exist. We have some major structures instrumented, the Frontier Building, the Atwood Building, the Hilton Hotel, the Veterans Administration Building, and we're starting to get some interesting information from that instrumentation. We can, for example, in the Atwood Building, with the type of instrumentation, we can look at translatory motion, the swaying of the building back and forth. We can look at torsion of the building. We can look at interstory drift between alternate floors. And we have an instrument in the basement in the corner where we can look at foundation rocking. And then John mentioned the downhole instruments on Delaney Park. We can look at the incoming seismic wave, relate that to the building response, and look at what's called site structure interaction. So there's a lot of interesting things that can be looked at from that instrumentation.
Does that information inform future building codes and how they might be designed? How much influence does that have?
Well, it can have a lot of influence. I mean, the building instrumentation, for example, we can look at compare that to the original design to see if there's any anomalies from a major earthquake, so we can look at the health of the building. There are research aspects to that instrumentation, too, where we can look at how a steel structure or a concrete structure reacts to a fairly major earthquake and perhaps change design techniques and detailing techniques for structures and influence future codes. So, yeah, it can give us a lot of information.
All right. So let's go to the phones. And we've got a couple callers on the line. Dennis is in Anchorage. Hi, Dennis.
Hello there.
Did you have a question?
Yeah, I got a couple comments, and then I'll move on to some questions. First off is that I attended Humboldt State University, which is about 30 miles in a straight line to where the San Andreas Fault comes on land. And the earthquake scientist there, Mike West, should know about that. There's a triple junction zone there, the Gorda Plate and stuff like that. So with that, HSU, Humboldt State University, developed a real strong geology department. And they had a class there. I wasn't in that geology group, but it was called Earthquake Class. And they used the book, Bruce Bolt's book. Now, I'm sure that Mike is familiar with that, but it was a great book. I've handed it out to quite a few people, some engineer buddies of mine, and they said, man, this is where everybody needs to read this one, especially on the civil structural engineering side. The author of that class, the teacher of that class, was Gary Carver. And he was a PhD, a renowned scientist. He worked on the jerky subsidence investigation there out of the Olympic Peninsula area. And he lives in Kodiak now. Mike, I don't know if you knew if he did, but he's a great wealth of information about him.
We all interact with Gary quite a lot. He is one of Alaska's shining stars when it comes to earthquake science.
Yeah, I was seeing both engineers nodding here in the studio in Anchorage, too.
Well, Gary is a member of the Alaska Seismic Hazard Safety Commission, of which Mike and I are both members, so we're very familiar with Gary.
And Dennis, did you have a question?
Because he is pretty proactive. The other one is I was at Cal Poly during the Northridge earthquake, which is about 150 miles north of that. And there was a big changes in from the UBC to the IBC, and that was driven a lot by the AWS D1 1-point welding code, especially with that uplift. And the other thing is you did talk about compressions versus sine waves and the earthquake effects. One of the things that you might want to touch on and is about the liquefaction. And what I always think about liquefaction, trying to explain it to people, is moving feet and wet beach sand. The effects on the earthquake to towns on the depth. And any comments that you have about the recent New Yorker magazine article that was in there. And that's about it.
All right. Thanks, Dennis, for those comments. I did want to get to liquefaction and West Anchorage as opposed to East Anchorage, where there's softer soils on the west side of town. So it's fine if we want to launch into a little bit of that right now. The map that was in the paper in the Anchorage Daily News, or excuse me, Alaska Dispatch News, really showed a lot of difference in, you know, just in my neighborhood from one end to the other. There was quite a bit of difference. What does that tell you about the soil compositions? And it must be difficult to be able to figure out what might work well for a building in this neighborhood as opposed to one just six or eight blocks away. So what's known about the geologic composition of the basin here? And at one point in time, after the 64 earthquake, you couldn't build in the Turnagain area, and now there's homes there. How did that happen? I'm seeing some looks being exchanged by the two experts in Anchorage here. Dr. Aho?
Well, actually, the liquefaction question probably should go to John Thornley.
All right.
I can talk a little bit about the building in the Turnagain area.
Yes.
Well, let's start with Turnagain.
Back in 1979, the Geotechnical Advisory Commission commissioned a report on ground failure susceptibility in Anchorage. And, of course, the bluff areas are areas where we can have a high potential for ground failure. And about that time, people started wanting to build in the earthquake, near the earthquake park area, in the old slide area. And the Geotechnical Advisory Commission was definitely against that, mainly because, you know, people that might have known about the type of failures that occurred in 64, but when they sell their homes, new people might not know. So we were a little against that and tried to make sure if the building was going to occur there that special things were done in the analysis in that area. And I think we were somewhat successful in doing that. But that's not the only area. I mean, all the bluff areas were a problem. And, for example, the Nesbitt Courthouse, we had a major interaction with the court system in the building of that courthouse. And the Geotechnical Advisory Commission actually caused a redesign of the foundation system to make that a much safer building. So, you know, there's definitely problems in certain areas in the bluff areas around Anchorage. And, yeah, we can change codes all we want as far as design techniques are concerned, but probably the biggest effect we can have on safety is the siting of major structures to stay away from areas that have a potential for massive ground failure.
Well, I talked to someone who lives in the Turnagain neighborhood, and he had bought his house in 1984, and he said, I wasn't told that that land had been sort of condemned for building before that time. He said, I was just told that I had to have earthquake insurance when I bought my house, but not it was not explained to him why. So that was of note to me. John Thornley, do you want to talk a little bit about the why that land wasn't considered suitable for building on because of the, is that related to the liquefaction concern?
It is slightly. There's I will say that the jury's still out as to whether whether the slope failures were exactly a liquefaction failure or just a what we call strain softening, which is maybe more esoteric than we need to go here. But there's some discussion between engineers about the real cause of those failures. I think the interesting piece of that, and I don't know if. If listeners have seen some of the images after the 64 earthquake, but Turnagain, just to underscore the amount of movement that we had there, the Turnagain area slid into the Cook Inlet about 2,200 feet, so nearly bordering on half a mile into the inlet. So there was a lot of lateral movement into the inlet. And a lot of soil moving out to be washed away as tides come in and out. So it was a fairly dramatic failure. And looking at it now, you don't see much of that. You see houses and you see trails, and we've kind of got back to normal life. But there is definitely a debate within the engineering community as to whether that type of failure will happen again. Dr. Aho suggested, there's a number of things that the municipality has done to help alleviate and reduce some of those risks by putting additional geotechnical evaluations on foundations and considerations of that kind of movement in the future. There have been additional and unique modifications to design and construction in that part of Anchorage.
Was there some more kind of stabilizing or any kind of hardening along that area where Earthquake Park is now? Has there been any work by the municipality to help make sure that that area is more stable, or have we just sort of gradually rebuilt in that?
I think we gradually rebuild. You know, there's some people believe that failure of that bluff had provided some stabilization to the bluff behind that still exists. But, you know, one interesting fact of that particular bluff area was 8 million cubic yards failed in that particular failure area. But the failure wasn't initiated until 2 minutes into strong shaking. So it took a lot of strong shaking and quite a bit of time before that bluff failed.
And then it continued to propagate. So there started with a minor failure and then moved, progressively back as time continued on through the shaking. So,
a fascinating conversation about a kind of scary issue, earthquakes. We will take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be joined by Jeremy Zedek with the Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management, just to reminding us about what we should do as Alaskans to be prepared for the next big event as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from
Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly. Alaska Pacific University delivers a distinctive educational adventure designed to support your personal and professional goals. Through generous APU scholarship packages and the new APU Promise Tuition Grant Program, APU is a sound educational investment in your future. Apply today at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We're discussing earthquakes and preparedness today. And joining us now is Jeremy Zedek. Jeremy is with the State Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management. Hi, Jeremy.
Hi, Lori. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for joining us. Give us a little bit of background about what happens at the Emergency Management Center when there is an earthquake where damage is reported.
Well, what we'll do is, whenever there is a strong earthquake, we recall staff to the State Emergency Operations Center, and we begin to call communities that are near the epicenter of the earthquake to find out if there's any type of damage. If the Tsunami Warning Center tells us that a tsunami is possibly going to be generated, we'll begin to call the communities closest to the epicenter, make sure that they've received the Tsunami Warning Center's warning, and then after the wave has passed, we'll call them back again to make sure that they received their, or that there's no damage, or if there's any assistance that they may need, that we can provide that for them. And it's just one of the many ways that communities are warned about a tsunami approaching their community.
Mm-hmm. Recently, we saw in Anchorage how quickly the shelves can empty out if a barge shipment has trouble getting here from Seattle. How long should people be prepared to fend for themselves if there's a big natural disaster in city or port services, especially if they're impacted?
Yeah, in the lower 48, they say people should have enough supplies for 3 days, but up here in Alaska, we say 7 or more days. And the reason being is, you alluded to it, the Port of Anchorage, about 85% of the goods comes through the Port of Anchorage, and then is distributed throughout the state. So there's really a need for people here in Alaska to take extra precaution, be a little bit more prepared than people down in the lower 48. The good thing is, you know, here in Alaska, we have a big hunting and subsistence kind of community, and people do really stock up on food during the winter or during the summer months, and then they enjoy it in the winter. So, you know, I think that Alaskans are a little bit more prepared by our nature, but really kind of takes a mindful approach to preparedness. You have to look through, make sure that you have everything that you need for 7 days.
And would you increase that number of days for rural residents? I mean, in the cities where supplies are, once they do get to the state, they're going to be in the city and dispersed first. Do you add days for rural residents?
Well, we just recommend having a minimum of 7 days.
Okay.
It really depends on your community, how much you want to prepare. I think that some rural folks, because they have a very kind of seasonal window to get supplies into their community, people do kind of stock up when those barges are running, when they can get those supplies in inexpensively. And then they also do the hunting and fishing to kind of stock up their freezers. But, you know, freezers, even in these spring and fall months, it can be warmer. And so people need to have a little bit of extra fuel, maybe an emergency generator to keep those freezers frozen and make sure all of their food is nice and cold.
Mm-hmm.
The real thing is, when you're looking at preparedness, we have checklists for it, but they're not really hard and fast checklists. They're more guides because each family is different. We have a big state. We have a lot of different regions, and it really takes a person to look at what they're going to need for those 7 days and build their kit that way.
And Jeremy, my last question for you would be, what's reasonable to expect from local and state government, and what does the government expect from its citizens when there is an event such as a natural disaster?
Well, you know, we always say that all disasters are local, and it really comes down to that individual and that family to kind of to have a good comprehensive emergency response effort. If we can get those individuals and families to be prepared, the local government has a much easier time going and providing for those folks that weren't able to prepare or their preparedness efforts were destroyed by the disaster. Borough government can come in and support those local governments. State government can come in and support the boroughs, and then the federal government, and so on. So, you know, what people can expect is the state's going to be there, their borough government's going to be there, local government's going to be there. But if they can take the time before the disaster to kind of prepare themselves, they're really putting themselves in the best position, and all the other support that can come after the disaster makes it so much easier for those emergency responders because they're not trying to provide food, water, shelter for folks. They've already taken care of that for themselves.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Jeremy, for your time. And you heard it, Alaskans. Get ready and be prepared because it's incumbent upon all of us to make sure that we can take care of ourselves for at least 7 days. Might be longer. We never know. We're talking about earthquakes today. We had a listener question by email about the direction of the energy of the waves. And that was something that I wanted to ask about, too. It seems like the Iliamna earthquake and the 7.1 near the Kenai area, the energy seemed to move up toward south central, up toward Anchorage. What's known about how, is there a way to gauge which direction the energy is going to go when an earthquake occurs? Is there any way that that's measured or can be determined? And does that help with kind of mapping and what may have to be determined in the future as far as buildings and other things like that?
About can I start this?
Please,
and
Michael.
To
yes.
John Thornley.
Yes.
When an earthquake happens, think about a fault on the surface. You've got earth that moves one direction, while on the other side of the fault, it's moving the other direction. So that absolutely sends out different shaking in different directions, or a different radiation pattern, as we say. And that's something that can be measured instrumentally. Actually, it's quite simple. Sensors in one direction pick up stronger shaking than in the other direction. So at the source, that's one of the reasons that energy is sent differently in different directions. But then there are the effects that John was talking about earlier, the influence of geology, the influence of other factors around that maybe extend shaking or focus it or funnel it. And that's certainly something we see in southeast or in southern Alaska. Sorry.
Mm-hmm. John Thornley, did you want to add to this?
Sure. I would, I'd ask the listeners to think about what they saw after the earthquake, as well as I was doing a little survey around the house shortly after 1:30 in the morning. What I found was a number of objects on the walls facing east and west had been thrown from the shelves, if you will, whereas walls that are in the north-south direction didn't seem to have much taken off of them. And in one spot that I obviously hadn't done very good dusting, I found that that a carving that I had moved moved south about 4 or 5 inches, and so right there, there to me was an obvious case for the north-south direction being stronger than east-west, and so challenge the listeners to think about what they saw, and see if that adds up for them. It's an interesting thing you can do just at home.
Well, that's spectacular.
It's a good thing that you hadn't dusted. That's a science experiment there. So
I had hanging light fixtures in our kitchen, and I could tell the direction of the earthquake just from the sway of the light fixtures.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to the phones for just a moment. Roger is in White Mountain. And if you would like to join us, the number is 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK, or in Anchorage, 550-8422, 550-8422. Hi, Roger.
Oh, yeah. Good morning. Our locales around the world with higher than normal mountain ranges, are they more susceptible to big earthquakes? You know, like Nepal and South Central Alaska comes to mind. I'll hang up and listen to your response. Thank you.
So Roger's asking, are the height of mountains, does that determine anything as far as how susceptible an area is or may be for earthquakes?
Mike?
Yeah.
You know, in terms of gross generalizations around the world, there would be some association.
Interesting.
Think about it this way. It's not that mountains cause earthquakes or anything like that, but why do mountains exist? Well, mountains exist primarily because of the motions of plate tectonics and, you know, one plate coming against another and in some way causing land to be uplifted. Mountains don't last forever. They'll eventually be worn down and eroded. So in order to keep a mountain range, you've got to have some sort of active process. Well, the way that the earth moves, these active processes, that is earthquakes. So in general, there's some correlation, but it starts to break down at the local level. You don't want to say, oh, there's a mountain, so I expect earthquakes. But that is why Nepal has earthquakes. It's why Alaska has earthquakes. It's why the Andes have earthquakes. So, you know, by and large, there's a correlation.
Aha. Uh-huh. So if you're afraid of earthquakes, stay away from the mountains. We had an email question from a listener who has quite a bit of technical information here that I'm sorry, Dave, I'm not going to be able to get to all of this. But one question he had that I can ask is why are there no, and maybe there are, but he's asking why are there no strong motion sensors at the port of Anchorage, which is so essential to much of the state?
We, in the new port design, we, as both a geotechnical commission and a seismic commission, have recommended that that they consider putting instruments at the port of Anchorage. So right now, you know, it's definitely a financial consideration. There's some expense to doing something like that. But because of the cost of that port, and the importance of that port, it's really a good idea to have an instrumentation program there.
There was a really good question here from a listener also about she was staying at the Sheraton Hotel on the 12th floor when the earthquake happened. She said, what types of structural supports are in hotels related to earthquake, and does the exit stair have a different type of structural support than the building? So, Dr. Aho, this is probably a question for you.
Well, you know, because of the L shape of that building, it's going to experience some interesting earthquake forces. And but, you know, it was designed to the whatever codes were in effect at that particular time. And I can't remember when it was built, maybe in the 1980s. So it would have been built to that particular code. Of course, every 3 years we have a change in codes. Mm. We have earthquakes that occur. We go and visit those earthquakes and see why buildings stood up or why they failed and try to modify design techniques, detailing techniques, and codes to address the types of failures that occur. And as I say, that particular building you know, was designed to a current code. It was whatever steel detailing was in vogue at that particular time. And stairwells are not, they're designed to withstand earthquake forces, but not anything special. Mm-hmm. And people should recognize that earthquake codes are designed to essentially have no damage under minor earthquakes, maybe moderate architectural and a little bit of structural damage under moderate earthquakes, and not collapse under major earthquakes. So it's not that a building is necessarily going to be usable after a major earthquake, but we don't want collapse.
Mm-hmm. And always stay away from the elevators. You should always head for the stairs, correct?
Well, yeah.
All right, we had another question here, an email question that is really interesting about weight distribution. And this listener says, if snow has come off half of the roof but not the other half, this is like one of those story problems from grade school, is the house much more susceptible to damage in a large earthquake if you've removed the snow from half of your roof?
Well, I mean, any added weight, high up in the structure, is not a good idea. But I don't know if you could say something like that.
It may not be measurable.
It may not be measurable.
Not enough weight to really make much of a difference. Let's go back to the phones here. We're getting some calls stacked up. Stu is on the line. Hello, Stu.
Hey, thanks. I'm calling about the lake ice and all these curious cracks that are showing up. They got this black, often black-brown water came out, and I remember the ADN reported a musher on the, one newscast reported a musher on the Big Sioux, saw water shooting up 3 feet in the air out of these cracks. Anyhow, the cracks are, one of the scientists said, they do seem to be on the east and west sides of at least the lake that I was on, and the crustaceans and other matter came up, and the dogs have pointed it out that there's these like shrimp-like animals out there on the ice now, and they stop and eat them, which was kind of interesting. But I wonder if anybody studied the cracks on the ice, and also could someone talk about the tsunami that occurred on Kenai Lake during the 64 earthquake? I understand it was 13 feet and took the ice right up onto the shore. And so can you call the forces that caused these cracks in local lakes a tsunami? And also, could you talk about how to shut the gas off on people's houses, since so many houses burn?
I can answer one question. And when you get wave action on a tsunami, on a lake, it's called a seiche rather than a tsunami. But other than that, I don't know that much about it.
Michael or John Thornley?
You know, I'd like to know if someone has done a systematic analysis of cracks on lakes following earthquakes. It's quite possible, but I just don't know. We have records of those going back a long ways, certainly 1964. I've seen photos from the Huslia earthquake in 1957, aerial photos of spectacular patterns in lakes. And in some ways, we're kind of uniquely poised in Alaska to do this. We got a lot of lakes, and they're frozen often. That said, I'm not sure how much science, at least earthquake science, there is in that. Because as John Aho just mentioned, what you're largely seeing is not so much the shaking of the earthquake itself, but the water sloshing around, or the seiche inside of the lake.
All right. Well, let's go back to the phones for a moment. Tim is in Juneau. Hi, Tim.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. Did you have a question?
Yeah. I have a couple questions. And the first one is, the recent earthquake in South Central was followed by an earthquake a day or two later. I don't know specifically, but on the Russian side of the Bering Sea. And I'm wondering if there's a relationship between those, you know, in that time frame. And also, if there's a relationship between large earthquakes around the Pacific Rim, say in the last 60 years, it seems like we've seen some enormous earthquakes, some of which were bigger than what was thought possible, like, say, for the Japan earthquake, and how that relates to a fault like the Cascadia fault that hasn't slipped in a long time.
All right. You know, I want to hear this answer to this question, but we're going to have to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll be talking about comparing earthquakes and are they related, as Tim and Juno has asked, as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from
your friends, family, and neighbors at Raven Alaska, connecting over 100 communities across the state. Find out more at flyraven.com. Artists make us think and question. They excite and engage. Artists inspire Alaska. The 2016 Rasmussen Foundation Individual Artist Awards Grant Program is now accepting applications. Individual Artist Awards support Alaska artists in 10 creative disciplines at all career stages. The program is open to Alaska residents only. For details and to apply, visit rasmussen.org/IAA. The deadline is March 1st, 2016. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We are in the final 10 minutes of the program, which is kind of unfortunate. I wish we were 2 hours today because I've got so much more I'd like to talk about. But we had a call from Juno. Tim was asking about comparing earthquakes and also about the fault lines. So let's talk a little bit about, are those earthquakes related, as he was asking? Is there a way to determine that? Michael, maybe we should start with you.
Yeah, Tim's not going to like my answer because I'm going to be very hand-wavy. This is a very challenging question because we don't have huge numbers of earthquakes in close proximity. So just because two events occurred, you know, kind of close in time, kind of close in space, we are generally lacking sort of a physical process where we can say, oh, well, because of that, this happened. That said, there are enough correlations out there to certainly raise one's suspicion. I'll throw out a couple that are on our mind. The earthquake the other day actually occurred a mere, I don't have it off the top of my head, maybe 30 kilometers or so, 20 miles from the Iliamna earthquake here this past summer. Unrelated? They absolutely could be unrelated. I wouldn't rule out some small effect. Another one that gets people's attention related to 1964 is that after the 1964 earthquake, there was not another sort of high magnitude 8, magnitude 9 earthquake globally for 40 years until Sumatra. And now we've had a series of them just in a decade or so between Sumatra, Chile, Tohoku, Japan, a number of these. So correlation or just plain randomness, the jury's still out.
Yikes. Well, today the White House hosted an earthquake resilience summit to promote adoption of an earthquake early warning system in the United States. And Senator Jeff Merkley of Oregon spoke. I listened to some of this, and he supports funding for an early warning system. And he said the concern about the Cascadia Fault is that there's a 1 in 7 chance of a magnitude 8 or 9 in the next 50 years. What's the latest on early warning systems, and what kind of help could this provide? What kind of advance warning could there be? How much? Michael?
Oh, go ahead.
Go ahead, Mike.
I can give a quick primer on the concept of earthquake early warning, because last week actually provided a nice example, though this is not something we do at all in Alaska. But many of your listeners will have felt the initial shaking, the primary waves, as John described earlier, and then 30 seconds or more passed before the strongest shaking occurred. And during that time, I know people were sitting there thinking, is this over? Or is it about to get a lot stronger? Mm. And you don't have that answer. An earthquake early warning system attempts to analyze those very first waves. If you can analyze and process that very quickly and say, oh, wait a sec, this is actually a big earthquake and you've got T-minus 17 seconds until it arrives, there's 17 seconds. I'm pulling that number off the top of my head, but there, you know, there's a time that you have to do something else with in terms of preparation. So that's the concept that's being explored, actually in use for better part of a decade now in Japan. Mexico actually has some earthquake early warning systems related to Mexico City. And the West Coast, California, Oregon, and Washington are aggressively pursuing this right now.
And I would add to that with that 17 seconds, it doesn't sound like a lot of time for you and your house, but But if first responders are dialed into that, they can open up the doors to the bays for fire trucks and emergency vehicles and be able to open those doors before there's any damage to the facility, which is a key issue when you have a major earthquake, is being able to open up a door, say an overhead rolling door, and so they can get the emergency response vehicles out of the building before any consequential damage occurs and be able to respond to actual needs of the citizens. So
it's also time for duck and cover and turning off very important equipment and making sure that it's safe.
So is it likely that in the future, if there were good early warning systems in place, that things could be automated, that gas lines and other infrastructure that you would want to be shut down could be have some sort of alarm system that would allow that to be shut in until the danger has passed? Is that what we're aiming for?
Yeah, well, in structural instrumentation, excuse me, that's one of the things that could be done, that the shutting off of very important equipment could be tied to the instrument at a particular floor level and automatically shut down equipment that you don't want running during a major event.
My last question is, what areas of Alaska are the most vulnerable, both for large earthquakes and for tsunami? I know that there was some confusion in Southeast with people that I talked to about when there was the large earthquake down there in 2013. And people, I spoke with folks in Sitka who said, well, I don't think a tsunami could come in here because we're kind of in the inside waters. What's the reality there? Michael?
let's take this apart. You had a couple pieces.
And I only have a
most
minute.
Most hazardous areas. The important thing is what we're actually talking about is risk. So hazard, there might be a tremendous threat posed by a particular earthquake, but if there's not a population close by, we don't have as much to worry about. So there's two factors there, both the earthquake hazard and the population, the fragility of the population. Same thing with the tsunami risk. This is why the state puts a lot of attention toward mapping out inundation zones and defining evacuation routes. And we probably shouldn't go into details here, but those are both very, very active pursuits in the state.
All right. And we will link to both preparedness ideas, and there's a lot of other links and information, some fascinating maps and data on our website, alaskapublic.org. Thanks so much to my guests, Michael West, state seismologist, John Aho, John Thornley, and Jeremy Zedek, who all joined us. And thanks to the callers. Sorry we didn't get to everyone who's on the line yet. I also wanted to let people know that there is tonight in Fairbanks at the University of Alaska Fairbanks at the Geophysical Institute, there is a discussion on tsunamis, how nature keeps surprising scientists. This is tonight at 7 p.m. in the Westmark Fairbanks Hotel Gold Room. The lecture will last for about 45 minutes with a question and answer period at the end. Thanks so much to you for listening. I'm Lori Townsend.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. The Older Persons Action Group is the publisher of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper and the 2016 directory for older Alaskans. To order the directory or to learn more, go to seniorvoicealaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
Happy New Year! Start the year off right by filing your 2016 PFD application. Don't forget to sign your application electronically or by printing a signature page. The deadline to apply is Thursday, March 31st, 2016. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.